Thank you very much, Dr. Gibas, for this introduction. First, I would like to thank Professor Lackner for this wonderful research opportunity. I would also like to thank Mrs. Hamm and all the fellows because they were really kind and available, so they made my first weeks here very pleasant. So my contribution to the program Fate, Freedom and Prognostication intends to analyze a conception of the mandate and to explore its possible mantic application in a pre-modern Chinese context. Based on exegetical and mantic material, my research project aims to determine the correlations between philosophical conceptions and Confucian practices during the Song Dynasty, and therefore to contribute to the questioning on the porous boundary between theoretical knowledge and empirical engagement. So considering the richness of Jussi's writing and his philosophical influences in East Asia, I think that his philosophy is highly representative of literary spirit in pre-modern China and constitutes solid points of comparison for intercultural dialogue. So first, what may be called the mandate? As you may know, and as Dr. Corey explained it last week, in ancient China, the term mandate, Ming, is of vital interest to the Confucians, and it essentially refers to the mandate of heaven. So what does it mean? The mandate is precisely the notion that justifies political legitimacy. For instance, this is because of heaven's mandate that the Zhou dynasty replaced the Shang dynasty. That means that the Zhou king was more virtuous than the previous king. So first, the mandate is understood as the dynastic mandate and is only conceived through its relationship with heaven. So here pops a second question. What is heaven? Heaven is at the same time the physical sky, which is above us, and a supreme entity. Heaven is a cosmic presence, a reactive and majestic entity which settles the cosmic process and the human behaviors. So heaven is bright, it punishes the bad and rewards the virtuous. Heaven can express its approbation or its anger towards a good or bad government. That is because heaven gives the power to the king in order to give peace to the people and to the country. So this idea of mandate is the basis of all Chinese political theory. The reflection on the mandate takes place within the framework of the couple human beings heaven. But according to a chapter of the classic of rituals, The Doctrine of the Mean, the notion of mandate also entails an immanent dimension, as it is related to human nature. We learn from the first sentence of the Doctrine of the Mean that what heaven confers to man is called the nature. Following one's nature is called the way, and cultivating the way is called education. So one's education is the key to the understanding and following of the way, which is the condition for fulfilling one's nature. Confucian thought relies on the idea that a human being is perfectible. Education is a factor of constant improvement. Moral education is transmitted by a master and by the practice of rituals. In a Confucian outlook, moral education is also the condition of exercising political power. So this teaching to fully become a man is essentially for the sovereign who should use virtue, not force, to rule his kingdom. Making his virtue shine guarantees subjects' loyalty and social harmony. then everybody follows the way, and the way here is understood as the way of the ancient kings of antiquity. As Confucius' figure may embody it, the mandate is something that can be personally and directly received from heaven. Receiving the mandate allows Confucius pursuing his quest of the way for a dozen years through many states. But as we know, Confucius didn't succeed into convincing the Spring and Autumn kings to put virtue of humanity at the core of their politics. So we could say that being unsuccessful in becoming a political counselor, yet successful in making his theories on humanity and politics renowned, appears to be Confucius' mandate. Here, the political mandate and communion with heaven is converted into a sole moral mission, a sort of moral consensus, namely the sense of humanity. In this perspective, human being has hold solely on his or her moral behavior. What a human being cannot act on is the realm of heaven and its mandate. Later on, during the Warring State period, another Confucian thinker, Mencius, elaborates on the notion of mandate. For him, the mandate refers to the conditions that are beyond human control, what is simply given, like the facts of our lives, such as where, when, and to whom we are born. But Mencius also had the idea that the legitimacy of governing may not only be found through heaven, but also through the people, since the people is exactly the moral expression of heaven's mandate. The sanction to bad rulers that heaven could send through, for instance, natural disasters, may be here redesigned through the sign sent by the people, meaning that the sign that a sovereign is accepted by heaven is when its people naturally recognize him as a good sovereign. The ethical power seems to be more important than the political one. So, the classic Confucian perception of the mandate seems to be rather fatalistic one. In other words, the mandate is what cannot fail to happen and belongs to the realm of the necessary. One may then wonder if the Song Dynasty's Confucian revival proposed a different conception of mandate or heaven's mandate. But first, a few words on the Song Dynasty. It is generally accepted that it is between the 10th and the 13th centuries that appeared in China a phenomenon comparable to the European Renaissance and its reinterpretation of antiquity. Under the Song Dynasty, China indeed knew an unprecedented economic, scientific, and technical soaring. This is, for example, the beginnings of archaeology, the first scientific catalogues, or the development of mobile character printings. This period also represented a flourishing time for pictorial arts, literature, and a revival of the moral thought initiated by Confucius during the Chinese antiquity, or, as Western sinologists call it, Neo-Confucianism. So, Neo-Confucianism, or Song Confucianism, firstly refers to the school of principle, then to the school of mind, which both appeared during the Song Dynasty. To say it briefly, the first one, the school of principle, is also called the Changzhu school, in reference to the masters Changyi and Zhuxi, claiming an approach world based on objectivity. The second one, the school of mind, or the Lu Wang school, was founded by the scholar thinker Lu Qiuyuan and continued by Wang Yangming during the Ming Dynasty, advocating the predominance of mind over principle and a subjective relationship to the universe, this school nevertheless remains in minority. As the history of Chinese thought shows, after the death of Confucius, his ideas got systematized through the philosophy of Mencius and Xunzi. Later on, after China became an empire, Confucian thought provides a solid theoretical ground for the Han dynasty. Afterwards, Confucianism is still very important, but Taoism and Buddhism also get a certain political influence. It's mostly under the Tang dynasty that the authority of Chinese traditional thought declined for the profit of Buddhism. Buddhism entered in China through the Silk Road in the first century of our era, and later on Tang dynasty, Tang dynasty is often qualified as Buddhism's apogee in China. Nevertheless, the scholar Han Yu declared that he is the heir of the authentic Chinese intellectual and cultural tradition. In other words, the heir of Confucianism. Han Yu rejects Buddhism. His ambition is to restore Confucianism and its original way. Despite Han Yu's efforts and writings, according to the tradition, that is precisely during the Song Dynasty, not the Tang Dynasty, so between the 10th and the 13th centuries, that China will experience its strong revival of Confucianism. Matrix of a new orthodoxy about to spread throughout East Asia, the Song Confucian intellectual movement unifies the tradition of the classics. The classics are sometimes compared to the gospel in the West. These texts are the major, the permanent, and the referent text of the Chinese intellectual tradition. By relying on the classics, Song Confucian thinkers defend the idea of a government based on ancient China's moral value that the ruler and official then put into practice across the empire. The first emperors of the Song dynasty are making the choice of a centralized state that is based on the civil power. Although subject to fiscal and military issues, the new dynasty emperor gives to the scholars and administrators a great power. Officials are recruited through an examination system, selecting men not only for their talents, but also for their competence, men able to fully engage in concrete political action. At that time, the educated class is an elite that considers itself as an essential moral pillar whose power, distinct from the imperial power, would be able to ensure the sustainability of the empire. Zhou Dunyi, a scholar official, was raised to the position of Confucian revival's founder by the orthodoxy established by the great master and theorist Zhu Xi. Zhu Xi built an ideological filiation based on his own idea of the Confucian way and chose thinkers who revived the tradition. Thus, Zhou Dunyi becomes, after his death, the savior of the Chinese philosophical tradition. His principal writings, articulated around the Book of Changes, are therefore the cosmological and moral basis of this first modernization of Confucianism. It is customary to consider that the orthodox thinkers of the Confucian way were all representatives of the school of principle, and as a consequence, all based their philosophies on the concept of Li, usually translated as principle, order, coherence, structure, reason, etc. Although these studies may be criticized, the history of Chinese thought shows that the several uses of the concept of Li seem to support theoretical and practical strategies for challenging the influence of other doctrines such as Buddhism or Taoism. The concept of principle, whose importance is relative in ancient Confucian thought, becomes fundamental in premodern Confucian thought. Moreover, even if the Confucians of the Song Dynasty mostly followed Mencius' naturalistic and moral thinking of heaven, one may also notice that this notion was reinterpreted. Heaven is considered as the source of the cosmic order, which entails both the natural order and the moral order. Zhuxi, the designer of the Confucian transmission of the Way, is the main figure of Song Dynasty's Confucian revival. He had the ambition to structure a tradition through his philosophy, but also to rebuild a Confucian society through his official function. Zhuxi intends to purge any Buddhist influence of Confucianism heritage. Zhuxi decides to sum up the Confucian learning into a corpus that will be called the Four Books. These four books are the Great Learning, the Doctrine of the Mean, the Analects, and the Mencius. The first two are actually chapters of the Classic of Rites. Of course, Zhuxi adds commentaries to this textual selection. That way, Zhuxi offers a clear and exhaustive program to engage oneself on the Confucian learning. Based around a revisited corpus, Zhuxi's action generates a new relation to the latter. The sole erudition is not enough anymore. Studying the Confucian way must lead to an entire transformation of the individual through circumscribed practices as well. From that moment on, Zhuxi becomes the great architect of Song Confucianism. His commentary will be the basis of the imperial exams till the end of the Chinese Empire. His influence expanded to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. So for Zhuxi, in order not to impede the universe's process and to contribute to it, one should first understand why things are like they are, but also understand how they ought to be. Inherited from the thinker Chang Yi, the solution Zhuxi proposes is to look for, to see, and then to know the principles of each being and each thing. In order to do so, Zhuxi engages the study to study the Confucian text, but he also mentions several spiritual or bodily practices that could help to attain the goal of seeing principles. According to Zhuxi, this exercise would have the benefit to nourish the moral potential of our human nature. They are presented as legitimate method of personal moral cultivation that lead the one who practices it to engage itself into social and political issues. But to what extent are these related to the issue of the mandate? Or to say differently, what is Zhuxi's conception of the mandate? As Professor Joseph Adler pointed out, Zhuxi seems to distinguish two dimensions of the notion of mandate. Actually, for Professor Adler, as well as for Professor Michael Nyland, there are two aspects or sorts of mandate. Unlike them, I would rather speak about two dimensions, since using the term aspects focuses on the appearance of something, whereas considering its dimensions insists at the same time on something's extent or scope, as well as its importance. So that being said, the two dimensions of the mandate are a personal one, meaning one's given quality, and a cosmological one, namely the circumstances of one's birth. So first, the personal or internal dimension of the mandate. The personal dimension of the mandate relies on one's endowment of vital energy, or qi. each human being is born with a unique endowment of vital energy. In other words, one's innate physical constitution differs from another one, as their qualities may be different. For instance, one may be born with clear and fine vital energy, or on the contrary, one may be born with turbid or impure vital energy. And these peculiar and variable dispositions of vital energy are precisely what determines one's longevity and fortune, but also one's ability to fully realize its nature. It will be more difficult for someone whose vital energy is unclear to purify it and then to fully develop his or her innate good nature. And this idea leads to the external dimension of the mandate. Ming is also understood by Juicy as the sum of the external and objective factors or the circumstances in which one is born. For instance, one's day of birth may be shiny, one's family differs from another family or community. All these variable cosmological but also socio-political elements nourish one's life and determine the internal dimension of the mandate. In other words, the external factors precisely determine one's disposition of vital energy. For instance, if the sun and the moon are clear and bright for the birth of someone, this person will be endowed with such a vital energy. The conditions of one's birth find their sources in heaven, and they cannot be changed. This is what heaven decrees. As far as I know for now, in Juicy's commentary to the Analects, especially on Confucius' idea that at the age of 50, one may know heaven's mandate, Juicy affirms, heaven's mandate is precisely heaven's way spread and bestowed into human beings. That is, therefore, the reason why they are like they ought to. Knowing heaven's mandate is knowing at the utmost its essence without being perplexed nor needing to say a word. Regarding the apprehension of the mandate, everything seems to be a matter of knowing or a matter of perceiving, discerning, and then understanding what it is and which dimension of the mandate one is dealing with. Knowing the mandate is what a man should strive to do through his mind and to accomplish through its nature. Furthermore, this distinction between one's mandate and heaven's mandate may be developed through the issue of correctness. We can notice that in his exegetic work of the Confucian master's writing, Juicy relies on Mencius' interpretation to explore the two-dimension notion of mandate. Juicy especially describes the difference between a proper or a correct mandate and a non-proper one. For Mencius, nothing happens that is not due to the mandate. One accepts willingly what is proper. Therefore, the one who knows the mandate does not stand under a crumbling wall. Juicy sees here the external dimension of the mandate, but also one's discernment in relation to it. He explains, at people's birth, what is auspicious and inauspicious, unfortunate and fortunate, are all what is decreed by heaven, but only that which is beyond one's control is proper mandate. So the noble man, cultivates himself and waits for it. That is why he willingly accepts it. Mandate here means proper mandate. A crumbling wall is a wall that is about to fall down. Knowing the proper mandate implies not standing in a dangerous spot to choose the misfortune of annihilation. So there is a predetermined canvas that is beyond our control and therefore necessarily acceptable, since it was decided by heaven for us. But as a human being, man has the intelligence to discern it. That is what one is able to know. Properness comes from heaven, but as intelligent beings, we also have the ability to differentiate what would be good for us and what wouldn't. Here we encounter the issue of choice. In line with Mencius, Ducie says that as human beings who are able to distinguish proper mandate from improper mandate, we can fully understand that dying because of a dangerous situation that could have been avoided cannot be perceived nor considered as decreed by heaven. It is only the result of a stupid behavior. It would not be an inevitable death. But then what is an improper mandate? Precisely for Mencius, to die after fulfilling one's way is proper mandate. To die like a prisoner in fetters is not a proper mandate. Ducie interprets the interaction between heaven and man as a successful dynamic between human nature and heaven mandate. He says, if one fulfills one way, then what is of auspicious or inauspicious value is always beyond one's control. Fetters are the punishment of a criminal. So this says that dying from a criminal offense and standing under a crumbling wall are both human choices. They do not result from heaven. So freedom of choice or free will based on one's moral value may be a possibility. It exists as an act apart from necessity. We could have a certain control over our life or destiny within the framework of our actions. Knowing what results from heaven's mandate and what doesn't has moral consequences. Ducie also declares in his commentary to the Analects, mentioning the nobleman's respectful fear for heaven's mandate, not knowing heaven's mandate is the reason why a petty man is not aware of righteousness and principles, as well as he won't be afraid of the consequences. One may afterwards wonder how these personal and impersonal dimensions of the mandate precisely enclose to Ducie's global philosophical discourse. In addition to a complex interpretation of mandate, Ducie defends a theory in which conformity or union to principle would be a cosmological and moral imperative. In line with the Chang brothers, Ducie indeed postulates that there is a universal and necessary principle that orders the world. Moreover, the principle is one, its manifestations are many, meaning that the underlying pattern for the cosmos is inherent to each and everything in the universe. The particular manifestation of the principle reflects the cosmological and moral role each thing or being has to play in the universe. There is a bond that unites mandate to principle, and it reflects heaven's full operative capacity. As Ducie explains in his classified conversations, principle is heaven's constitution, and mandate is the principle's function. So there is a necessary and complementary connection between heaven, principle, and mandate. The mandate could be interpreted as the operational mode of the principle, but it is only the beginning of my research on this topic. There should be more elements to corroborate or to infirm this hypothesis in Jussi's writings regarding the mandate, especially in all the explanation recorded in his conversations. For now, concerning the links between the mandate and the principles, I noticed in Jussi's commentary to the Analect that knowing heaven's mandate is investigating principle and probing into human nature. And we saw at first that for the doctrine of the mean, what heaven confers to man is his nature. So here, Jussi, also following the Cheng brothers, affirms that fulfilling one's nature necessarily implies looking for the principle. And certainly, heaven's principle, since Mencius said that knowing one's nature is knowing heaven. Jussi also affirms that heaven's mandate is the proper principle that heaven is endowed with. So is the mandate also a principle? For sure, the notion of properness or correctness may be applied to the mandate and to the principle. As we can see, in Jussi's case, the notion of mandate cannot be correctly studied without the consideration of the notion of principle. But to what extent may a stable cosmological and moral foundation be legitimized through this structural articulation? Can this prioritization of principle as the constitution over mandate as the function only be considered as relevant? And how does it apply to human actions? From Jussi's Confucian outlook, one should practice self-cultivation through extending knowledge and knowing principles in order to attain sagehood. The two dimensions of the mandate that we saw are both conditions for the apprehension and understanding of the principle. According to Jussi, those who obey to heaven's mandate conduct themselves in light of principles and act on an auspicious time, not daring to act on behalf of their self-interest. So everything goes back to the principle, since knowing the mandate appears to be knowing principle. But for Jussi, one may only discover the mandate after having made efforts. When he discusses some of Chang'e's saying in his classified conversation, Jussi refers again to the Mencius and affirms. So first, it's a question of the disciple. In the posthumous writing of the Cheng brothers' discussion on the mandate, a comment says, "There are no sage who would not know the mandate, but regarding human affairs, a sage can help acting. What does it mean?" And Jussi answers, "Naturally, a man has his own mandate, but he has to willingly accept his proper mandate. Like the one who knows the mandate doesn't stand in front of a wall which is about to fall. If one thinks he has his own mandate and goes standing in front of a dangerous wall, he will not be able to speak about the mandate once he's buried under this wall. Getting to the bottom of human affairs is the mandate." I must admit that, like Jussi's disciple, I have difficulties understanding this last sentence, "Getting to the bottom of human affairs is the mandate." It seems to imply that it is only after having made a reasonable choice that one may be allowed to know its mandate. Allowed in the sense that using one's reason, is the condition for knowing one's mandate. The behavior that conform and respect ethical rules or common sense may be seen as the appropriate reaction to the mandate. By reaction, I mean the moral response a person could have to a situation brought by the universe, one's morally active participation to the world. So we have seen that, like the concept of principle, the mandate also had an external and descriptive dimension. Things are what they are. There is not necessarily a sanction to human behaviors. But the mandate also has an internal and prescriptive dimension. Heaven's decree is heaven's moral obligation. One should stick to its principle. Considering one must act in accordance with heaven's principle and with heaven's mandate, Jussi's discourse on divination should also be explored. Or to rephrase it, how may Jussi's peculiar conception of the mandate echo at a mantic level? Jussi's interest in the Book of Changes lies in the moral implication of the cosmological principles. Since the hexagrams are a symbolic representation of the principles themselves. But in his classified conversation, Jussi recognizes that the Book of Changes was originally created for divination. So what does this affirmation imply? The purpose of the Book of Changes is essentially practical, not theoretical. But it also implies that the Book of Changes, created by Fuxi and fully recognized by Confucius, is therefore integral part of the Confucian way. One may wonder to what extent Jussi's interest for the Book of Changes may reflect his attempt to reinforce the Confucian way. As one of the original sources of the Chinese culture, the Book of Changes may be used as a strategic and efficient tool for challenging Buddhist ideas and Buddhist consideration, or rather unconsideration, for the phenomenal world. As Jussi puts it, as for divination, since Fuxi, Yao, and Shun have all used it, and there is a principle for it, now, if people today have doubts about an affair, they reverently use divination to decide on it. Why couldn't they? If so, for Jussi, the practice of divination through the turtle and the yarrow, prediction of the auspicious and inauspicious, could be a legitimate and powerful instrument in the process of moral self-cultivation, as well as a means to reach the goal of becoming a sage. In 1186, Jussi then wrote a commentary on the Book of Changes entitled The Original Meaning of the Book of Changes. In that book, Jussi elaborates on the philosophical and religious contents of the hexagrams. Furthermore, and this is what will mostly fill up my days during my stay at the consortium, in order to make the Book of Changes an understandable and useful manual of divination, Jussi also writes, in collaboration with his disciple Cai Yuanting, an initiation to the study of the Book of Changes, which entails precise instruction on the Book of Changes method of divination, but also an extensive commentary on the symbolic and numerological meaning of the line, trigrams, hexagrams, or also diagrams associated with the Book of Changes. Jussi also called his own book a small book of divination. This book is composed of four parts. It was written for the beginners in the study of the Book of Changes in order to clear their sayings about it. Here the word study, xue, should be understood in its Confucian sense as a practice, not only something theoretical. Understanding this book is not only an intellectual exercise, it's a life experience. Juicy considers that in Song China, many students of the Confucian way enjoy discoursing on the Book of Changes, but in his opinion, they mostly concentrate on the signification of the characters and elaborate without having a proper basis. And of course, Juicy is the one who will provide them with such a basis. Analyzing Juicy's only book on the theory and practice of divination will bring out elements to investigate his intention to melt a theoretical discourse on the mandate to a practical one. If, as I said earlier, the hexagrams are representation of the fundamental principles, what does it imply regarding the theoretical articulation between heaven principle and heaven's mandate? Besides, one may wonder how Juicy's emphasis on the notion of principle inherent normative character, what should be thus, influences his divinatory conception of mandate. How could the reading of the Book of Changes be used to determine how to act in particular situation? Leading a good life implies to be aware of its mantic conditions. One must nevertheless keep in mind that Juicy's critical point of view on divination, is critical, since he defends a limited use of the Book of Changes. Juicy stipulates that divination should only be used in precise circumstances. For instance, when a man has reached the limits of his capacities and cannot decide the correct course to follow. In the foreword of his initiation to the study of the Book of Changes, Juicy affirms, "The Book of Changes enables all people of later ages throughout the world to decide uncertainty and doubt, to settle indecision, and to be undeluded about following the auguries, auspicious and inauspicious, repentance and regret. This achievement may be called great." Therefore, one may ask if, in this outlook, resort to the Book of Changes is mostly a way to cope with the future, but also a way to apprehend the present. The use of the Book of Changes appears like a guide for choosing one's appropriate way or direction through an immediate course of action and to follow it in a proper moral manner. The Book of Changes indeed provides us with the discernment to detect incipient changes in events and their potential direction. It enables people who use and interpret it correctly to adapt their own behavior to the direction and course of the way and thereby to maximize the moral flourishing of their lives and efforts. In keeping with the idea of moral self-cultivation, the use of divination may help a person to purify one's vital energy, then to attain a spiritual clarity. And that would, as a consequence, lead to the expression of one's inborn good nature. Unlike the Confucian student, for the sage, there is no need for divination, because he is always able to respond appropriately and spontaneously to changes in the human and natural environment, whatever they might be, simply because of his spiritual clarity. Such a superior man already knows what is auspicious and what is inauspicious. He attained the stage where he knows heaven's mandate. An example of such a superior man is, of course, Fuxi, the one who designed the trigrams of the Book of Changes, but a closer example to Juicy is the figure of Jodumi. As I previously said, and as some of you already know, Zhou Dunyi is considered as the founder of the Song Confucian revival. Zhu Xi conferred upon him such a glorious position. Zhu Xi affirms in his introduction to Zhou Dunyi's major work, Penetrating the Book of Changes, after Confucius and Mencius, the way of the sages was not transmitted for more than 1,000 years because there were no sages to transmit it. Even though the Han dynasty lasted 400 years, only Master Dong appeared. Tang dynasty lasted 300 years, but only got Master Han. They both failed in the transmission of the way. That is, only arrived to the Song dynasty that Master Zhou appeared and that the filiation began to continue. Since then, the following generation didn't express differently. Here, Zhu Xi aims at convincing that Zhou Dunyi is the first true Confucian sage since Mencius, and the explanation lies beyond Zhou Dunyi's personal mandate. Zhu Xi puts it into an historical, political, as well as a cosmological perspective, and indeed affirms, with the decline of the Zhou and the death of Mencius, the propagation of the Confucian way was not continued, even less so from the Qin to the Han, Tin, Sui, and Tang until our Song. Then, sage founding father of the Song received the mandate. The five planets were in conjunction in the constellation Kui, marking a turning point in culture. Only then did the heterogeneous vital energy homogenize, and then the divided vital energy coalesce. A clear and bright endowment was received in its entirely by one man, and the master, Zhou Dunyi, appeared. Without following a teacher, Zhou Dunyi silently registered the substance of the way, constructed the diagram of the supreme polarity, and attached a text to it to give a ultimate foundation to the essentials. So it appears that the destiny of Chinese thought is inseparable from the destiny of Chinese dynasties. We can see that Zhu Xi precisely uses the notion of mandate to affirm his view on the Confucian way and on its orthodox representatives. Zhu Xi noticed Han Yu but doesn't choose him as the one who revives the Confucian way. Zhou Dunyi's process of legitimization as the founder of Song Confucianism seems to rely on Zhu Xi's interpretation of the mandate. The historical circumstances, as well as the personal circumstances of the birth of Zhou Dunyi, all made the continuation of the Confucian way possible. But we can question this information and the way Zhu Xi transmits them. They are presented as objective facts from which he affirms something that appears to be true. Apparently, Zhu Xi communicated with Zhou Dunyi's spirit, but how does he explain it? So first, these cosmological and energetic circumstances appear to be the auspicious signs of the mandate. But is Zhu Xi reading the signs he is intentionally looking for? Second, we could say that referring to the mandate intends to prove Zhu Xi's architectural construction of the Confucian way. I will have to investigate other material, especially his conversations, to see if I could find elements that would justify such affirmations. Moreover, if there is a mandate, that means that there is a principle. Randomness doesn't appear to be optional for Zhu Xi. So the appearance of the sage Zhou Dunyi was an example of heaven's mandate and seems to be the proof of the moral character of the mandate. The figure of Jodhuni is here an embodiment of heaven's mandate, of proper mandate. To be the sage figure of the Confucian revival was also Jodhuni's own mandate, and he willingly accepted it because, as Jussi specifies, Jodhuni produced essential writings to the Confucian way. The circumstances of his birth were favorable. The configuration was special, but not random, since it followed the cosmological and moral principle of the universe. So, as first conclusions, I can say that the intensive use of the Book of Mutation as a major Confucian reference in pre-modern China prompts us to study the links between philosophical conception and the interpretation or practice of divinatory arts. The contemporary reflection on the political uses of the Book of Mutation in pre-modern China will, in my opinion, be enriched by the analysis of its primary aim, namely divination. The fulfillment of human nature is based on the knowledge of one's mandate. Thus, the moral self-cultivation may require the practice of divination. The principle seems to be the concept Jussi relies on to interpret the mandate. Jussi rethinks the mandate in natural and ordering terms. He doesn't immediately rely it to a discourse on political nature. Jussi's intention seems to offer a theoretical canvas that allows the concept of principle to supplant or deepen the traditional Confucian notion of mandate. Besides, the use of the Book of Changes is, for Jussi, a means to see and understand principles of the universe. Jussi developed several spiritual and bodily exercises in order to do so and to purify our vital energy. For instance, the didactic one, as reading and studying the Confucian classics, allowing to emptying one's mind and appeasing one's vital energy, or the meditative one, as practicing quiet sitting, invites the mind to be peaceful and vital energy to be still. And we have seen through the example of the practice of the Book of Changes that by paying attention to one's life circumstances, one can also apprehend the universe's cosmological and moral principle, and at the same time purify one's vital energy. Thank you.